Dakota has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across Central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the east and north sides, including Easton and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at coda.com/service changes. That's coda.com/service changes.
The Book Program, presented by Hannah Murray.
Good evening. Welcome to tonight's book show. My first guest is Tessa Dunlop. She's a historian, writer, and broadcaster, best known for her work on BBC Two's BAFTA award-winning series, Coast. Her latest book, already a Sunday Times bestseller, is The Century Girls. It's a celebration of the 100 years since British women got the vote, told in their own voices by six centenarians. Olive, Joyce, Edna, Helena, and Phyllis lived that change. And in the book, they share what they saw, how they were treated, who they loved, what they did, and where they are now. Also with us is Caroline Mitchell, who's an ex-police detective and best-selling crime author. She completed 10 books in 3 years, recently reaching number one on Kindle in the UK, the US and Australia. Before becoming an author, Caroline worked for the Essex Police Force for 9 years in numerous different roles, including detective and sexual offences trained officer. Her latest novel, Silent Victim, splits the story between three voices and the blurred lines between victim and predator in a innocence and guilt and deceit and protection. Also back with us on the book show is Cherry Radford, whose writing is inspired by lighthouses, the sea and flamenco music. Her latest novel, The Lighthouse Keeper's Daughter, is the perfect escapist holiday read. It's a modern tale of romance and discovery, inspired by Cherry's friendship with a well-known flamenco guitarist in Madrid. And finally on tonight's book show is Harry Sidebottom, who took his doctorate in ancient history at Oxford and has taught at various universities lecturing in ancient history. His first book, Ancient Warfare, A Very Short Introduction, was published in 2004 to critical acclaim. His foray into fiction began with Fire in the East, the first of his six novel Warrior of Rome series, which has sold over 500,000 copies worldwide. The Last Hour, his 10th novel, introduces us once again to Marcus Clodius Ballista, hero of the Warrior of Rome books. That's all on tonight's book show on Talk Radio Europe.
The Book Programme, presented by Hannah Murray.
Joining us on the line now from the UK is Tessa Dunlop. She's a historian, writer and broadcaster, probably best known for her work on BBC Two's BAFTA award-winning series Coast. She's also the author of Bletchley Girls, which was published in 2014. It's great to have her back on the book show to talk about her latest book, a Sunday Times bestseller. It's called The Century Girls, the final word from the women who've lived the past 100 years of British history. Welcome to the book show, Tessa.
Hello, how are you?
I'm all right, thank you. I'm all right. Great to have you back with us on the show, and what a fantastic idea for a book.
Thank you. It's been the most immense fun writing it, I've got to say. It was great fun finding the women and then building relationships with them. I wrote The Bletchley Girls, and I realised my mistake with that book was there were too many women, 15 women. It's hard to emotionally connect as the writer, indeed, to keep up with 15 women, and I think so too for the reader. So for this book, I decided I would focus on just six women through which it's their stories that shed light on the bigger story that was Britain over the last 100 years. But because there was only six, I had to make sure each woman represented a sufficiently different story within Britain's history, if that makes sense. It's like sort of doing an X Factor for centenarians, choosing them.
And they really do have some amazing stories to tell. They're fascinating women.
Yeah, they are, actually. I was very keen because, of course, 100 years ago, it's the Russes that sort of tied to the anniversary of women getting the vote. But 100 years ago, Britain had an enormous empire. I think it's really easy to forget that now because things have changed so quickly. And I really was keen to get women who were also born out with the British Isles and grew up in Empire. And I managed to do that, which was very pleasing, because it took a bit of finding. Olive is just the most tremendous character. She was born in Guyana, British Guyana, which is in the northern part of South America. And she was one of the first black women to come and live in London in the early 1950s. And then I had Phyllis, who was born as a, she was a white person, but she was also what's known as a domiciled Indian. So she was born in India and didn't come across to live in the UK until mid-war, because she had met her future husband, who worked on an oil tanker. And just 2 weeks later, she accepted his offer to marry. It's quite funny, because one of the other things that's changed so remarkably, not just the sort of political and the professional aspect of women's lives today, but also sex and the social revolution. You know, of these women, those that did marry, all of them were virgins when they got married, without question, really.
Wow, isn't that interesting? And how do they feel about how that has changed?
Well, funnily enough, Helena, who's she's heaven, she's Welsh and has lived in Brecon most of her life, and she always says, oh, can you believe how ignorant I was? Like, she just can't believe how little she knew. And I was very struck, for instance, that of the six women, four did not know what was happening to them when they got their first period. Such was the silence around women, female anatomy, biology, intimacy, and sexual relations. It just was not handed down from mother to daughter.
Isn't that sad?
Yeah, well, it's extraordinary. I mean, Helena was the oldest of eight, and yet she reckons she didn't know where, how, she knew where babies came from. She knew they came out of the tummy, but she didn't know how they got there.
Mm.
She said, my father always said, don't you go getting into trouble now. But I didn't know what trouble meant, she said.
And
it's
did
extraordinary,
they,
isn't it, how different things are?
Definitely. Just, and did they all change that when they became parents? Did they all educate their own daughters in a different way?
Not hugely. I mean, you know, we're still, Britain, I think, to hang, society becomes, in theory, more permissive, if you like, in the 60s. But Helena was bringing up a teenage daughter in the 60s, and her daughter said, no, Mum never talked about it. And Helena said, oh, but I knew there was information available in the public domain by then. You know, you could get the pill. So I just hoped that would, you know, that would happen if need be. But we're, no sex, please, we're British. We're famous, aren't we, for the sort of Victorian, Edwardian, not letting it, you know, not speaking about it.
Mm. Yeah,
and we obviously societally we do it now, but it generally, I think that's again been a second shift that's come much more recently in the last 20 years, really.
Mm. And did the women think that was a good thing? Did they see that as progress?
Joyce, who's Mary Beard's tutor, very academic, and still working in Cambridge, you know, says you can't presume that things always get better, that progress, you know, automatically is going to happen. And I think for some, they're slightly bemused by the speed at which some aspects of modern living have changed. And for others, I mean, you know, Joyce never even got married. So that kind of, that precluded intimate relations with a man by definition, really. And yet she feels, because she was in a university campus, she was very much part of that social change when it came in the 60s and 70s. And I think she would regard, as a highly educated woman, she would regard more choice for women as a good thing. Although she caveats that with, you know, we can easily lose what we've won. We need to be careful. This is precious and vulnerable still.
Yeah. Saying about Joyce, you just said she's still working in Cambridge. She's 99 and she's still working.
She is. Yeah, she proofed my book. She proofed Mary's book. She does what's known as epigraphy, which is it's a specific sort of strand of classical studies where she translates the inscriptions on ancient tombs and sites. And so she has a lot of translation still to do before she dies. And so she's busy working. I have to very much book in time to see her. And we're performing together, actually, in the Cambridge Union at the end of April. And she said to me, oh, in my day, when I first came to Cambridge, women weren't allowed to speak in the Union. So it's quite pleasing that aged 100, she's going to be headlining there. She's actually the youngest in the book. I call her the baby spice of the book because she was born in 1918. The oldest in the book is Anne, and I went to her 104th birthday on Saturday.
Oh, wow.
And yeah, she's amazing. I don't know when I'm going to wobble over, she always says. She's so lovely. I love Anne.
And what did she do for her 104th birthday?
Well, we just had a lasagna with the local vicar. Although I'm not religious, there's four things that don't impinge: pets, religion, music, and sport.
Okay.
But I think when you get very old as a woman, you rather miss male company. By definition, invariably, your husband's dead. And people who care for the elderly tend to be women. So I had a local, you know, knew the vicar who knew lots of people she knew, so I got him to come round as well. And I just noticed that she quite enjoyed, you know, having a man's company for an afternoon.
Yes.
And why not? The body withers, the ego persists. Hannah,
and
discovered.
Interestingly, Anne is the daughter of the famous publisher Frank Sidgwick.
Yeah, that's right. And they published If I Should Die, Think Only This of Me, That There Is Some Corner of a Foreign Field That Is Forever England. That's Rupert Brooke. Her father had just published his book and his poems when he died.
Oh, how amazing.
Mid-war.
And she's,
yes, extraordinary.
Anne...
She was born before the war. She remembers the end of World War One. It's quite extraordinary, isn't it?
And she's never owned a television.
Never. So you have conversations with Anne and she doesn't know what the word shag means. She thinks it's a bird. And then and when we talk about cool, she's like, I think of cool as in not hot. And I'm like, no, Anne, it was cool to have a shag if you were gay by the 60s. She's very, but weirdly, she's very, very progressive. So not weirdly, but, you know, I think a lot of people presume that we become more conservative as we get older and that you carry with you the ideals and morals of your generation. But Anne was a sort of flirting with communism in the 30s. And I was in the art world. I mean, most of the men I knew were gay. It was ridiculous that the laws were so behind the time. And she knew Kenneth Robinson, who she was a very good friend of his, who became the Labour Health Minister and was very important in finally seeing the Wolfenden Report acted upon and the legalisation of gay sex for men.
Mm.
Which, of course, came about 10 years later than the recommendations.
Yeah. And going back to Helena, who you mentioned, she did a GCSE in Welsh at the age of 90.
Yeah, she's so cool, Helena. And she did, for anyone who's listening with Welsh heritage, the Eisteddfods are hugely important in Welsh culture, which is their sort of bardic celebration, national and regional, of Welsh language and culture. And very competitive. It's like sort of the mods in Scotland or the Highland Games. And I and Helen has been performing at Eisteddfod's all her life. And they're very big, like hundreds of thousands of people go to the national ones. And at the national one in Abergavenny in 2016, she won a Lifetime Achievement Award. Because she'd always performed in Welsh, but she hadn't, you know, she'd learned stuff off by heart in Welsh, but she hadn't really been able to write and do her own stuff. But in her 90s, after her GCSE, she was finally able to write her own stuff in Welsh about her family history. And then she won her first Eisteddfod Award. That was in her mid-90s, but then in 2016 she won a Lifetime Achievement Award, and in 2017 she was made the Gorstad of the Bard made her a druid, which is a very big compliment in Welsh culture. So she wore all these blue robes. It was hysterical. I drove all the way to Anglesey to see it because it just so sounded so other. And it was great. She was 101 and she was all dressed up as a druid. And she's won, actually. She was awarded an MBE in the New Year's Honours this year for her services to Wales.
Oh, fabulous. And Edna, who is 102, has never travelled beyond England.
No, and she is an arch-Brexiteer. That may or may not surprise you. All the rest, in fact, remain, because I was really interested that we all think that Brexit is something that is more prevalent among the older generations.
Mm.
And what we do is we lump everyone over 65 in the same category. But in fact, if you're 103, you're a generation and a half older than a baby boomer of 65.
Yeah.
And your politics are very different. You grew up with mass unemployment, with fascism on the horizon. You grew up without an NHS, you know, and you didn't hear about the war in the 50s. You were part of Europe ripping itself asunder. So your politics are quite different, actually, from those who grew up in the shadow of the war.
Yeah.
And so that's why there is a sort of, there tends to be, I've anecdotally discovered, a sort of tends to be a more liberal attitude politically. But Edna was an exception, a domestic servant all her life, so kind of crushed by the social hierarchy. And yet, ironically, all her life voted absolutely staunch conservative voter until 2015 when she voted UKIP. I know. Only Edna.
Funny.
But she didn't like Thatcher because they both came from Lincolnshire and she felt Thatcher was an upstart and also sold off the council houses, which she didn't approve of.
Fascinating. And she also rejected the Queen's offer of a birthday card.
Yes, she did. Oh, well, I know what those big houses are like. Impersonal. Impersonal. I think the Queen did a very good job. But, you know, not for me. I know they're great. They're all, I mean, I can't tell you, I do really love them. We've got really close. They're just great women. Great, inspiring, generous. So much love and time and advice. And I'm devoted to all of them. I feel very lucky to have them as my friends.
Yeah, that's lovely. And just one more I have to ask you about Phyllis, who you mentioned earlier, who's 100. She spent her 100th birthday party in Edinburgh Zoo.
She did. Well, she volunteered there for years and years. She was classic, actually. A lot of people think that after the Second World War, you got a sort of second wave of woman's lib. You know, like you had the big watershed in 1918 with the vote. But there was no kind of feminist watershed at the end of the Second World War. And and Phyllis was very typical, really. She had a bit of a grotty job in a munitions factory and couldn't wait to get home and have a baby and be a wife. Mm-hmm. And the 1950s, of course, in terms of equality, didn't really happen. Women went back to the home and bred for Britain. And that sort of second wave of women in the workplace and equal pay and stuff was very much a 60s, 70s movement. So Phyllis never worked again after the Second World War, but she did do huge amounts of volunteering and work in the community. I mean, she was really engaged and important to her Edinburgh community, which is where she came to live, you know, when she left India. And Edinburgh Zoo was one of the places she worked in, so that's where she had her hundreds.
How wonderful. What a great project to have done, Tessa. And I understand how you've become so close to these women. I get that.
Yeah, I mean, they've just been supportive of me too. It wasn't a hugely easy year for me on a number of levels. And I've not found them in any way judgmental. They've just been very kind and always have time for me. They're just great. Mm. Yeah. And at the book launch, I had three came to the book launch. Even Anne, who was 103 at the time, and she did a speech and wore a hat.
That's fantastic.
Yeah, it was good fun. It was really good fun.
I think
anyway, if anyone reads the book, they must just email me something. You can, or you know, let me know what they think, if they've got any messages for the women, because they love feedback. They love feedback.
Oh, great stuff.
Well, everyone loves feedback, don't they? That's the thing.
Yes, for sure. If people want to get a copy of the book, it's called The Century Girls, and it's absolutely fabulous. It's by Tessa Dunlop, who we've been chatting to today. Tessa, have you got a website or a way people can contact you?
Yeah, just go to tessadunlop.com and there's contact details. Scroll down and there's my email address and they can just email me.
Fantastic.
Brilliant.
Will do.
Okay.
Tessa, thank you so much for joining us.
Great to be on your show again, Hannah.
Thanks, Tessa. Take care.
Lots of love. Bye.
The Book Programme. Presented by Hannah Murray.
Joining us on the line now from the UK is Caroline Mitchell. She's an ex-police detective and best-selling crime author. She's had phenomenal success since she began writing, completing 10 books in 3 years and recently reaching number one on Kindle in the UK, USA and Australia. Before becoming an author, Caroline worked for the Essex Police Force for 9 years in numerous different roles, including detective and sexual offences trained officer. She's with us on the book show to talk about her latest novel, Silent Victim. Welcome to the book show, Caroline.
Hello, thanks for having me.
Pleasure. Thanks so much for joining us. So tell me, when you were working in the police force, did you think that one day you'd be an author?
Well, it's funny you should say that. In the last few years of my career, I was forever scribbling down little notes and things that my colleagues used to say. And they found it very amusing when I'd pick up a funny anecdote and say to them, "Well, you don't mind if I use this at some point, do you?" So, yes, in the last couple of years, I did. I wish I'd have thought of it sooner, really, because after 9 years, I'd accumulated a lot of experience. And I do wish I'd kept more note of some of the jobs I dealt with. But it's all in my head.
Yeah. So was there a lot of inspiration then? There was a lot of juicy material, if you like.
Yes, definitely. It's all about the people you meet, and it's as much can be said about police colleagues as it is the criminals and suspects and victims indeed that we dealt with. So there's a lot of authenticity in the writing there, is that we know, you know, in the police world how it works and how it's a big family and how we keep each other going in the tough times. And of course, yes, you do meet the very interesting characters that you deal with on a day-to-day basis as well.
Yeah. So tell me, is this your 11th book, is it?
Yeah, I've written 10. Yeah, I've got 10 out there. So Silent Victim would be my 9th. My 10th is due out later in the year. So I have been very busy.
Gosh, absolutely. So how are you writing so many books in a year?
Yeah, I was writing 3 a year. I mean, I'd already written some when I went on and I got the publishing deal. So I was kind of set up with that. And it started from there in 2015. I published my first book with Bookature. And since then, I've been writing 3 a year. But now I've decided just 2 a year is enough for me. It's I think it was in the police. I used to work very, very long hours. So I was used to that work ethic. So when I left, I just carried on working those really long hours. So people used to say to me, how do you write so much? And I said, yeah, but I write all day. I take short breaks and I write, you know, for, I could be working for like 12 hours a day. So to get the books done, and that's how I do it. But I am slowing down now. I'm getting old.
Oh, so it's been like a full-time job for you then as an author?
Oh, yes, definitely. And I'm very lucky to have it. I mean, it's a joy to be able to work from home, especially when you've got a family. So it's lovely. I'm very fortunate.
Yeah. And how about the success then? How did you feel when the books were doing so well?
Oh, absolutely thrilled. I mean, I can't believe I've reached over 500,000 readers, and I get messages from all over the world, and it just makes my day. I'm absolutely thrilled. But as you say, it's not just me. You know, you have a huge team behind you when you go out and publish and do well. It's not one person. It's a massive team of people who, from cover designers to editors to the publishers themselves, that really push you and help you along the way. And it's about having those people who believe in you to get you to where you need to be that really make all the difference.
Mm, fantastic. So tell me about, let's talk about Silent Victim, your latest book. Tell us about Emma.
Yes, I loved writing Silent Victim. It is one of these things that popped up in my mind during our conversation with my husband when we were talking about moving house. And I said to him, gosh, can you imagine if you were moving house and you had something really bad buried in the back of your garden? And that kind of all stemmed from a seed there. And basically, Emma, she's a loving wife. She's a mom. She's got a business. She's quite successful. But she has a secret buried in the back garden of her home. And that is the body of a man she had a relationship with when she was a teenager, and he was her teacher at the time. So many years later, her husband comes home and tells her he's got a promotion, they're going to move house. She panics, she goes back to find the body to move it, and the body is gone. So from there on, we hear the story from 3 different perspectives, from Emma herself, from her husband, Alex, when she confesses to him, he doesn't know how to deal with it, and he finds out lots of things about his wife, kind of wish he didn't find out later on in the chapters, and from Luke, the chap, who she had the relationship with. So it goes back and forward in time, and you find out about the relationship, and you begin to wonder who is the real victim in all of this, and who is telling the truth.
Mm, fantastic idea for a story. It's great. I love a story that makes you think, gosh, what would I do in that situation?
Exactly.
And had you, with the discussions with your husband, had you talked about what you would both do in that situation? You must have done.
Let's just say he's sleeping with one eye open from now on.
Brilliant. So can you tell us any more then about, obviously not wanting to give anything away, but how we would feel reading the book? I mean, are there sort of scary parts in it? It's a psychological thriller, isn't it?
Yes, I said it in Mersey Island in Essex, which is a brilliant setting for a book. It is quite creepy because it's a place where it gets cut off by the tide quite regularly. So the locals are basically, nobody can go in and nobody can come out. And I really like that setting. And of course, it is a very beautiful island as well, and it has a lot to offer. And it just meant for a brilliant setting. It is a little bit creepy in places. As in all my books, I don't go into gore. There's no, there's not lots of blood or gore or anything like that. But it's just that creeping, disturbing sense of the hairs prickling on the back of your neck. That's the sort of thing I want to get. And I suppose in a way of Gone Girl, in that you have that unreliable narrator as well, which I really love playing with. And of course, my own experience in the police comes heavily into play in this book as well, because I dealt with a lot of victims, as in student-teacher relationships and children who are groomed and not realised it. And of course, I've also dealt with people who are falsely accused of crimes and their predicament. And of course, the far-reaching consequences to not just them, but to their family and friends, and how it affects everyone. So I put a lot of experience into that book, but I'm very proud of it.
Yes, it must help massively to be able to use your experience in that way, because it would take a lot of research otherwise, wouldn't it, about police procedures and how things would work.
Very, very much so. And I used to interview vulnerable victims of crime as well. It was another level that I was trained in. And yes, it was hugely inspiring, the strength of victims, how they come forward and go through with things when you can tell how hard it is and how harrowing it is to have to relive it all again. So I took a lot from the people I dealt with. Obviously, I'd never talk about real life cases, but you do get a lot of experience. And you know, in the daily police workings, how things work on that end as well. And I use that in all my books, but it has been very helpful.
And whereabouts did you work as a police officer? Can you tell us that?
Yeah, it was in Essex. I was all over, really. I started off as a bobby on the beat. I was working in Walton on the Naze and in Clacton, then in Colchester, Chelmsford. You do tend to move around a lot. And over 9 years, I worked in lots of different departments. And I really enjoyed it. It was just the hours that killed me. The hours were so long and I never got to see my family. So aww. I really wanted to leave by the end of it. And it was a great way to go.
Yeah. And did you were you shocked by crime sometimes when things happened? Did you think, my goodness, I can't believe this has actually happened? Do you know what I mean? When we see things on the TV, we're well aware that it's fiction. But when you're actually in that situation, were you shocked by the things that went on?
Yes, in the early days that I was involved in some very serious incidents, and you just have to go back to your training, and your training does kick in. And when you're in uniform, especially, it just is like a shield almost. It protects you in a way that you become this different person. So you deal with it, and it's not till you go home that night till you start rolling things over in your head and go, oh my God, was I involved in that? Did they really do that? Someone died, you know, while I was there. And but it's mainly when you go home. And that's the thing that I relay in my police procedural novels, is that we're all human and it does affect us. But at the time, you just go straight into your training mode. And if you're well trained, you should know what to do. And it's later then that it creeps on you and you can't sleep at night. But yeah, lots of experiences and certainly things you just wouldn't believe if I told you.
Yeah, I always wonder how people who do that kind of job can switch off, can go home to their normal life and have dinner with their family and go to the park and whatever, and be happy and normal after seeing and hearing such awful things.
Yeah, and that's where your relationship with your police colleagues come in, because obviously you can't talk about work at home. They might say, oh, I had a tough day today, but you can't go into detail about cases.
No.
But with your colleagues, this black humour comes in very much, and it is that sense of being in a family and being there for each other and someone always having your back. And people who understand, who have been through the same experiences as you. So you do have that support mechanism in place there always. And it is great to be part of that. But they're a great bunch, just heavily overworked at the moment, unfortunately.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, we do our best.
That you do a great job. And it must be a weird thing. I hadn't thought of that, the idea of not being able to talk about things with your partner. You know, they can tell you about their job as long as they're not doing a similar job, but you can only say, yeah, tough day, and can't talk about it. That must be really odd.
Yeah, when it hits the newspapers, if it's a particularly serious crime and it hits the papers, you can obviously talk what's in the public domain. So that's okay. So I suppose in that way you can get around things. But yeah, but sometimes it's good to kind of leave it behind as well and not be talking about it at home, just to get on with your normal family life and try and forget about it for a little, because it can become all consuming.
Yeah, I guess. So what's next for you then? You mentioned that you've written the 10th book as well. That's coming out the end of this year, you said?
Yes, that's coming out in October, and that is called Truth and Lies, and I'm hugely excited about that, because that is a police procedural novel, and that's about, when I was coming up with the idea, I thought to myself, what's the worst possible thing that could happen to me as a police officer? And I thought, well, I suppose if I found out my parents were someone like, I don't know, Fred and Rosemary West, maybe serial killers or something awful like that. And then I thought, actually, that's quite a good idea for a book. So I had my poor, she's trying to follow in her adoptive father's footsteps because he's in the police, and then he dies and she discovers that actually she gets a letter from prison from this woman called Lillian Grimes, who is Britain's deadliest duo, her and her husband, and she informs her of some shocking truths, and poor old Amy Winter, who is the detective in this, has to come to grips with it. I'd really put her through the mill, but it's very interesting, and she's forced to visit this woman in prison and forced to face a past she thought she'd forgotten. And I'm really pleased with that book. It actually comes out the 11th of September, I've just checked, not October. I can't keep up with all my books, but
and that's called Truth and Lies.
Truth and Lies, yeah, that's on Amazon.
Brilliant.
At the moment.
Fantastic. Well, Silent Victim is out now and Truth and Lies out in a few months' time. We look forward to that as well. We've been speaking to the author Caroline Mitchell. Caroline, thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
The Book Programme, presented by Hannah Murray.
Online at tre.radio.
The Book Programme, presented by Hannah Murray.
Joining us on the line now from Almeria is Cherry Radford, who was a keyboard player in a band, a piano teacher at the Royal Ballet School, and a postdoc researcher at Moorfields Eye Hospital before suddenly starting her first novel in the middle of a scientific conference in 2009. She's with us on the book show to talk about her latest contemporary romance novel, The Lighthouse Keeper's Daughter. It's a modern tale of romance and discovery, finding out about each other and how the past always affects the future. Welcome to the book show, Cherry.
Hello there.
Hi, it's great to have you back with us on the show. How have you been?
I've been fine, thank you. Yes.
Good.
It's been a few years now, hasn't it? I think it was 2013 or something.
Gosh, yes.
Yes, with you.
So you spend half the time in the UK and half the time in Spain.
A little bit less in Spain, but maybe a third or something like that. But it's great, yes.
Oh, lovely. And how long have you been spending time in Almeria for?
On this occasion, only a couple of weeks. But we've had this home here for 2 years now.
So. Oh, great. So your latest book then, The Lighthouse Keeper's Daughter, I know you're inspired often by lighthouses, aren't you?
That's it. Yes, I am. I live very near the Beachy Head Lighthouse. Yes, it's something very special to me.
And what is it you like about lighthouses?
Well, I've been trying to explore that in one of my blogs, actually. You know, what is it? What is the allure of the lighthouse? I think it's many things. I mean, it's a symbol of security. I think for me, just architecturally, I find them beautiful. I love the thought of going inside, the coziness, and the minimalist living. It's a number of things, but I can't seem to lose it.
Yes. So tell me about your latest character, Imogen Bradfield.
Well, she's a woman who's just come out of a marriage, and she escapes to the coast, both to be alone, but also to discover more about what happened to her father, who was a lighthouse keeper who mysteriously drowned 30 years earlier in 1982. But in the course of finding out more about him, she finds that there's similarities in their lives, in that one of the things is that they were both sort of intensely corresponding with somebody. He had a young female pen friend she hadn't known about before, and she has a Twitter friend who's an acting musician in Madrid. So they've got these two things in common, but in the course of the book they find that these distant, irresistible connections can have life-changing consequences.
Mm-hmm. And I know that part of this story was inspired by your friendship with a well-known flamenco guitarist in Madrid.
Yes, it was. It was indeed. And in fact, I think we spoke about this last time I saw you.
Yes.
Yes, I have a very unexpected friendship with José Mi Carmona. That started with just one tweet. Basically, he'd come out with his solo album, and I couldn't find it on Amazon. I'd seen clips of it on YouTube, and I just thought, well, I'll tweet him and find out where I can get hold of it. And he tweeted back, and we got talking about English and Spanish and our children and one thing and another. And before I knew what, I was his sort of online English teacher. And a year later, we were invited onto a radio program on the Bourne Radio to talk about our friendship and our online English teaching.
Oh, how lovely.
Yes, yes.
So, isn't that amazing? So have you seen him perform?
Oh, yes, many, many times, because I spent a lot of time in Madrid when I was writing the book, but also since. And in fact, we'll see each other next month. And yes, Madrid is a part of my life now. I can't lose that.
How lovely, because you've been a fan of flamenco music for a while, haven't you?
For a long time, yes, I have.
And how do you explain that? Because it's a very, it's an acquired taste, I guess you could say, isn't it, flamenco music?
I think it is. I mean, when I first enjoyed it, it was just seeing the dancing at the Sadler's Wells Theatre. They have a flamenco festival there in London every year. And I liked the dancing mainly. And I, in fact, I took a course. But as time went on, it was more the music and even the singing, which earlier I found just too much. But it sort of, yes, it grew on me gradually. I got more into it, more I listened to different artists. And now I almost exclusively listen to flamenco or flamenco fusion. In my car, I think there's just flamenco and David Bowie at the moment.
Oh, lovely. Because people who like flamenco music are normally really passionate about it. It's a real love, isn't it?
Yes, I think it is.
So tell me a little bit more then about the friendship between your characters then, of Santiago and Imogen, and how they became friends.
Well, it initially mirrors what happened with Hosemi and me, in that he's needing help with his English, he's struggling with it. He's an actor in a soap opera, in a telenovela, whatever, in Madrid. And but he's got aspirations to do better than that, and she helps him with that. But that friendship develops over a course of time, and you know, as I say, in some ways similar to ours, in that it progresses to email, because Twitter becomes daft after a while, especially in those days, because you really could only do a small amount of words. And then Skype, and then eventually she comes over to Madrid, and they do meet. And I'm not going to say more than that.
No, fair enough. And how does, I know you mentioned it briefly earlier, but how does the lighthouse keeper's father come into it? No, he's the lighthouse keeper, isn't he?
Yes,
right, yeah.
No, not lighthouse keeper. No, her father was a lighthouse keeper.
Right, yes.
How it comes into it is that while she's there, she's investigating what happened when he disappeared. And in fact, her aunt is sending her these pages from his diary that he was keeping at the time. So she's seeing similarity in his friendship that he had with his pen friend and what's happening with her and her Twitter friend. So it's difficult to talk about it too much without giving things away.
Yes.
They're sort of parallel stories.
Okay. And do you know, when you come up with the idea about a new book and a new story, do you know where you're going to go with the story? Have you already decided the ending, or how does it work for you?
I do decide it, but there's always a few little things that need tying up, and I'm not quite sure. I know where I'm going to arrive, but I'm never quite sure how I'm going to get there. I always have some sort of options left open. And it's a funny way that the sort of characters turn up and then decide what they're going to do. And you have to just carry along and see what feels right. But yes, I do. I am an author who needs to have a plan. I don't completely wing it.
And are you quite disciplined with your writing? Do you spend a certain amount of time each day? And is it the same time each day that you decide to write?
No, I like to have several hours to get sort of immersed. I'm not very good at sort of grabbing an hour. I have to have at least half a day. I try to write whenever I can. Whenever I've got half a day free, I will write. But I don't sort of word count madly or anything like that. I don't think that's a good way of doing it. I think I chapter count, because I know how many chapters I need to do because of the plan. But I just see how it goes and take it from there.
So can you be quite flexible? I mean, if you have a free afternoon and think, okay, I'm going to write, do you ever have the situation where it's just not happening for you and it doesn't seem to flow, and then you have to say, oh, never mind, I'll do it another day?
I'd probably go for a walk or a swim. And I have this peculiar thing that every time I'm stuck, if I get in the bath or a swimming pool or the sea, it seems to unravel. I know where I'm going wrong, and then I can start again.
Oh, lovely. Well, at least you know what works for you. Well, if people want to get a copy of The Lighthouse Keeper's Daughter, it's out now and available to buy on the TRE website in our bookshop section. It's by Cherry Radford, who we've been chatting to today. Cherry, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
This is
TRE, the book programme, presented by Hannah Murray.
Joining us on the line now from the UK is Harry Sidebottom, who took his doctorate in ancient history at Oxford and has taught at various universities, including Oxford, where he lectures in ancient history. His first book, Ancient Warfare, A Very Short Introduction, was published in 2004 to critical acclaim. His foray into fiction began with Fire in the East, the first of his six novel Warrior of Rome series, which has sold over 500,000 copies worldwide. The Last Hour, his 10th novel, introduces us once again to Marcus Clodius Ballista, the hero of the Warrior of Rome books. Welcome to the book show, Harry.
Nice to be on it.
Oh, it's great to have you. Thanks very much for joining us. So tell me, you've obviously had a passion for history from a young age, I imagine.
Yes, I have, actually. I always had a passion for history, and it was my 16th birthday when my godfather gave me a biography of Alexander the Great by a man called Robin Lane Fox, and that converted me to ancient history, to Greek and Roman history, and set the path I took and ended up as a don at Oxford and historical novelist.
Fantastic. So when you were sort of learning more about history at Oxford, did you think that you might become a writer? You'd like to develop it into becoming a novelist, perhaps?
Well, weirdly enough, I always wanted to be a novelist. I only actually became a Don under the misapprehension that Dons actually didn't do much work, and I'd have enormous holidays in the summer. And the second misapprehension was I could write a novel in 3 months every summer. So kind of the novelist bit, or wannabe novelist, came before the academic.
And how did you find it once you did find the time to knuckle down and write? Was it much harder than you thought?
Much, much harder. Well, I was very worried initially because I thought, I kept it very quiet. I was trying to get some historical novels published. So I thought a lot of my colleagues would rather look down their nose at it and think, oh dear, poor old Harry, whatever scholarship he had, and now he's just writing popular fiction. In fact, the only person I told was Mary Beard, who was very supportive. Oddly enough, since the novels have come out, everyone in the academic world has been incredibly supportive. But going back to your question, yes, it's incredibly hard work. People have this idea that novelists just sort of sit around and do a bit of writing when inspiration strikes, and it's really not like that. I mean, you have to knuckle down and have a lot of self-discipline. I work from about 9:30 till 6 days a week.
Gosh. And also, I imagine when you're writing historical fiction, you have to do a massive amount of research and make sure that all your facts and dates are very accurate.
You do. Bernard Cornwell recently said he saw historical novelists as the gatekeepers of history, because we are read by far more people than are read by historians. And yeah, we've got a duty to get stuff right, or as right as you can, as right and plausible as you can possibly get it. Having said which, I mean, often the story, the surface story in my novels is made up, but all the background is as accurate as I can possibly make it. And I do try and visit every single location in my novels.
Oh, great. All in the name of research.
I don't know. Yeah, I don't know why my wife will keep referring to these trips as holidays. I mean, they're clearly research trips. I'm working every hour on somewhere nice.
Exactly,
like
taking notes constantly. So tell me about this Warrior of Rome series that you did before.
Right, the Warrior of Rome series was billed by Penguin, its publisher, as the Sharp series, but set in ancient Rome. They're, in a way, traditional action-adventure novels. In each one self-contained, but they have some stories run through from one novel to another. And I took the hero all round the Mediterranean, which was great fun.
Great. So why did you decide to go back to the same character of Marcus?
Well, I'd written the six warrior novels, and then I'd written a trilogy called Throne of the Caesars, which the Sunday Times was kind enough to call Game of Thrones without the dragons. I wanted to write something new. I'm not the kind of novelist who wants to write the same kind of novel every year. And I really wanted to write a thriller. a stripped-down, fast-paced, full of menace, bursts of explosive action thriller. And I decided I'd use Ballista, the hero of the Warrior Ones, in this new standalone novel. So I just thought he was a good, robust hero. People like him. And I thought, he'd be good in basically this new novel, which is 24 in ancient Rome.
Mm. So for people who haven't discovered Ballista yet, tell us a bit about him.
He's a proto-Englishman in that he's an Anglo-Saxon. He's a diplomatic hostage in the Roman Empire who has risen through the ranks of the army. He's married into a Roman upper-class senatorial family, but he's never trusted. I wanted him to be an outsider. Outsiders comment much more freely and obviously on the things they see around them. I mean, I always find it really weird in Roman set, or any historical novel, when characters who are Romans explain Roman things to each other. It just doesn't work.
No.
I mean, it just seems weird. Why would they do that? Whereas as he's a foreigner, it comes much more naturally in his mouth, and then I can tell the reader interesting, hopefully fascinating things about Rome.
Mm. So I guess you've been to Rome many times.
Many times, and I took yet another research trip stroke holiday for The Last Hour. Because The Last Hour is, I'm really excited about this novel, because it's a new departure for me in two ways. One, it being a thriller, and in another, because it's the first novel I've actually set entirely in Rome.
Mm.
So the entire action happens between sunset one day and the next sunset in the centre of Rome. So, yes, I actually walked everywhere Ballista went. Well, obviously, I didn't do the rooftop chasers. That, the police would have arrested me.
A bit too ambitious. Your wife wouldn't have been happy about that bit.
Well, nor do I. I'm scared of heights.
Fair enough. So why did you decide to set it in 24 hours? That's a good idea.
Well, it's the first novel that actually came to me in a flash, as novels are meant to, but they never do. I was thinking, right, I want a thriller, and I just had this image popped into my head of the hero standing on top of the Mausoleum of Hadrian, which is the modern Castel San Angelo, the sun setting behind him, the river Tiber is about 150 foot below him, the whole main city is spread out on the other bank, and the bad guys were coming up the stairs. And I knew then, in a moment, he's got 24 hours until sunset the next day, get across Rome, prevent the assassination of the emperor. If the emperor dies, all the hero's family die. And my only worry with this was, Rome, one of the most atmospheric locations in the world, surely it's been done to death. There must be any number of films, TV shows, novels, which take the basic race against time across Rome. And, I haven't found one.
Oh, wow.
Not a single one. If you know of any, please don't tell me.
No, I wouldn't do that. I don't, by the way. So was there any difference in terms of the writing process? How did you find writing a book that was set in 24 hours compared to some of your other works that were over a much longer period of time?
In one way, it's much easier. In my Throne of the Caesar series, there are multiple point of view, multiple storyline, and continuity was a nightmare. You have to make sure characters can get from, I don't know, Milan to Rome in a reasonable time. They have to be in the right place. None of that with The Last Hour. The problem instead was pacing, because you need a certain light and shade. I'm aiming for the reader getting a sense of relentless menace as the city watch try and arrest the hero, more sinister people try and kill him. But I didn't want to veer into that sort of Quantum of Solace, the Bond film, which is just one damned action sequence after another.
Mm.
So you need light, you need constant threat, but you need light and shade. You need moments when the hero can rest and take stock and plan his next move. And it was the pacing that I found the biggest and most interesting challenge. And in order to learn about pacing, I thought, learn from the best. So I'd never read any Lee Child, but I have read several now, and he really is the master of pacing in the modern thriller.
Mm.
It rattles along, but Jack Reacher isn't always in action. And I think it's always best to try and learn from the masters in any genre.
Yes. And tell us about some of the bad guys in the book.
Well, I don't want to tell you too much about the bad guys in the book, because I want you, the reader, to be in the position of the hero of not knowing just who they are.
Okay, fair enough.
He's stumbled into a conspiracy, and as the novel progresses, you, the reader, and he get little hints of the ramifications and the powerful men who want him dead and want the Emperor dead. But beyond that, I'm not going to say.
Fair enough. I respect that. So has it inspired you to write more books set in a 24-hour period, do you think?
I would like to, but not immediately.
Okay.
I like to move on. I mean, the novel I'm working on now, provisionally entitled The Castle of Silence, has a longer time frame. But again, it's very much a stripped-down action thriller. I really like this new way of writing books for me.
Mm.
And I hope, of course, that it'll appeal to readers of modern thrillers, not just to people who like Bernard Cornwell historical novels.
Yeah.
So to try and reach a bigger readership.
And do you know where your inspiration comes from each time for a new story or new character?
No. I usually have no idea at all. As I said, this is the first one there that came to me in a flash. I mean, some of the past novels, I've actually just looked at something, an object, and thought, "Oh, there's a germ of an idea here."
Mm.
One of my earlier novels, The Caspian Gates, when I was working at Oxford, I had to read a Latin inscription set up by a centurion about building defensive walls, which is very dull and very normal, except the thing was found in the Caucasus Mountains, hundreds of miles beyond the Roman Empire. And it just made me think, what on earth was this Roman officer doing there?
Yeah.
And from that germ, kind of a whole novel appeared.
Yeah, fantastic. Well, if people want to read your latest novel, it is called The Last Hour, and it's by Harry Sidebottom, who we've been chatting to today. They can buy a copy of the book on our website in the bookshop section, tre.radio. Harry, thank you very much for joining us.
It's been an absolute pleasure.
The Book Programme, presented by Hannah Murray.
Coda has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across Central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the east and north sides, including the Easton and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal, Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at coda.com/service changes. That's coda.com/service changes.